Chapter 4. South America's great Atacama Desert is a place unlike any other. Its climate is different, with close to zero rainfall but occasional thick fogs. Its plants and animals are different, what there are of them, which is to say almost none, capable of living with almost no water. Even its rocks are different. The floor of the Atacama is crusted and shot through with a riot of strange chemicals, nitrates, chromates, and dichromates, perchlorates, iodates, sulfates, and borates, chlorides of potassium, magnesium, and calcium minerals. So extraordinary, a researcher wrote, were it not for their existence, geologists could easily conclude that such deposits could not form in nature. How they did form is still a question. It is generally agreed that the area's dryness probably has something to do with it, that anywhere else in the world these minerals would not have had the chance to aggregate because they would have dissolved in the rain or been eaten by microorganisms or absorbed by vegetation. Because there is no rain in the Atacama, there is no life. There is some thought that the fog might play a part, or perhaps the nearness of the sea, or salts washed down from the Andes. Whatever the reason, the Atacama is the only place on Earth that significant deposits of these rare minerals slowly crystallized, century by century, to form the nitrate-rich mineral layer the natives call caliche. The richest layers of caliche are found in a strip along the western edge of the desert, just inland from the sea, over the hills Darwin crossed. This ribbon of desolation, 5 to 10 miles wide and a few hundred miles long, contained almost all the naturally occurring sodium nitrate on Earth, stored in layers of caliche as thick as a man was tall. In the 1870s, as the guano disappeared, the world began to appreciate its value, both as a fertilizer and as a component of fireworks. European and U.S. merchants bought it in small quantities for both purposes, and sometimes got them mixed up. One early attempt to import nitrate into England for fertilizer failed, the story goes, when Liverpool officials refused to accept it because the danger of explosion was too great. The captain ended up dumping it in the water. It took time for European and American farmers to appreciate its benefits, especially when all their attention was on the marvelous fertilizer from the chinchas. In the early part of the 19th century, bags of the desert nitrate were sometimes used primarily as ballast for returning European ships, a way to put weight in their bellies and possibly make a little profit on the side. The dynamic changed for two reasons. The guano boom ended, and a chemist figured out how to turn the South American nitrate, suitable only for making inferior explosives, into true saltpeter, China snow, the world's most important component of top-quality gunpowder. Only a single atom differed between South American nitrate and true nitrate, and when chemists figured out how to switch them, cheap Atacama nitrate suddenly grew in value. Making South American nitrate into true saltpeter was only the beginning. The newly made true saltpeter could then be chemically altered again to make tons of nitric acid, the basic ingredient used in making a new generation of high explosives like nitroglycerin, developed by Alfred Nobel in the 1860s, and dynamite, patented by Nobel in 1867. As the 1800s went on, increasing amounts of the Atacama products were shipped to Europe to make not better crops but better explosives, including those used in high explosive shells for the military. The fact that Atacama nitrates could be used for both food and war made it, in the latter half of the 19th century, one of the world's most valuable natural resources. For years, Britain had the upper hand when it came to gunpowder, thanks to its control of the true saltpeter deposits in India. During the Crimean War in the 1850s, however, the increased need for explosives sparked Britain's interest in the Atacama. The South American nitrate trade began to take off, with Britain soon joined by Germany and France, all three nations investing in nitrate shipping. The purchase of nitrate-rich Atacama land and the construction of refineries in the desert. The United States began boosting its nitrate trade in the 1860s to make gunpowder during the Civil War. Peru, which controlled the Atacama, began to make big money from the trade. Everyone started staking claims in the desert. The growing number of nitrate refineries in the Atacama drew thousands of Chilean peasants, tough, independent-minded, hard-working men and women who trekked north to Peru to trade their lives as agricultural workers, peasants, for the promise of steady, higher wages. Nitrate ports mushroomed along the coast, populated by prospectors, salesmen, water brokers, suppliers, prostitutes, British businessmen, German engineers, French shippers, and American adventurers. The richest diggings were in the northern Atacama, the district of Tarapacá, where under Peruvian law, almost anyone could claim about 10 acres of desert land and set up a nitrate refinery as long as they paid the government fee and taxes on what they produced. Families started staking as many claims as they could. Making the salitre, the refined nitrate, was difficult, dangerous work. The salts, in their raw natural form, caliche, were often buried below a layer of dirt and rock, so prospectors called barateros were hired to find the caliche, digging trenches to locate the salt layers, testing it for purity, the best deposits were around 50% pure nitrate, and deciding if it was worth processing. Quality testing in the early days consisted of grinding up a bit of caliche and throwing it on a fire to see how well it burned. The caliche was as hard as rock. It had to be blasted with explosives, and the baratero was often in charge of this as well. Then the calicheros came in, and the workers who shoveled away the dirt, dug out the caliche, pickaxed it into handleable pieces, and loaded on mules, and hauled it to the refinery. By 1863, there were 9 big new steam-powered refineries, locally called oficinas, operating in the Tarapacá, employing hundreds of workers to pulverize the caliche between iron rollers, boil it in big iron vats, purify the nitrate, then bag, load, and transport it. Production rose, exports doubled, then tripled, then went through the roof in the 1870s as the world ran out of guano and began to realize that there was not only fertilizer but also gunpowder in the desert. The caliche was so rich, the Atacama so big, and the supply seemed endless. As the long bender of the guano age ended, the Peruvian government sobered up and began to realize that its future was in nitrate. By then, however, most of the refineries, most of the production, most of the transportation, most of the brokering, and almost all of the shipping were in foreign hands, Chilean, British, German, and French. By the end of the 1870s, more than 25,000 Chilean laborers had entered Peru to work the nitrate. By the time Peru realized what it had, the whole area had been essentially colonized. But that made little difference to the leaders in Lima. What counted was not ownership, but the money that could be made to flow to the Peruvian government. In the wake of the guano collapse, Peru needed money. It had floated enormous foreign loans on the promise of continued guano production. By the late 1860s, Peru was one of the world's largest debtor nations. It needed whatever it could make out of the nitrates as quickly as possible. So just as they had done with guano, the Peruvians allowed foreigners to do the dirty work while the government raked in money from taxes, fees, and licenses. Iquique, which in 1869 was still little more than a shabby collection of unpainted frame buildings scattered along unpaved streets, as one visitor described it, had by 1871 been transformed into a frontier boomtown with almost 12,000 inhabitants. It was the Tarapacá's biggest city, the seat of local Peruvian government and home to swarms of new inhabitants who lined up at notary offices to lay land claims, fight over building sites, and try to corner markets on imported water and exported nitrate. Iquique became famous for its rough life, its loose women, and its alcohol consumption. The west coast of South America was a veritable paradise for drunkards, one historian wrote. Sailors set free after weeks at sea found little to do but buy a few tripas, long sausage-shaped skins filled with wine, 3 for $1, and go looking for trouble. One appalled English observer wrote of the typically ignorant, drunken, and grossly depraved English sailor in Peru. When on shore, if he is not drunk, he's kicking up a row. His language is foul, his manners brutal, and his appearance that of a wild beast. The sailors seemed to enjoy it. A number of them decided to trade life aboard a British merchant ship for life in Iquique and desert it, finding plenty of chances for work in the boom town, or joining the Peruvian army or navy, or simply drinking and combing the beach. Soon the best deposits were stripped. The early oficinas, small mills run by families for a few years until the richest nearby caliche was gone, then dismantled and reassembled at the next good diggings, gave way to larger, more efficient, more permanent factories. Even worked-over areas of the desert still contained enough nitrate to make money. It only required better methods to refine it. These incongruous, hulking mills in the blankness of the desert, sprawling, steaming complexes built with imported Oregon timber, fitted with European machinery and served by railroad lines, turned into small towns with hundreds of workers, stores, maybe a theater, a tavern, a brothel, a hospital, and their own brass band. An uncountable number of vast iron tanks containing colored liquids, as a visitor described a nitrate refinery in 1877, a tall chimney, a chemical laboratory, an iodine extracting house, a steam pump, innumerable connecting pipes stretching and twisting about the vast premises as if they were the bowels of some scientifically formed stomach of vast proportions. A blacksmith's forge, an iron foundry, a lathe shop, complicated scaffolding, tramways, men making boilers, men attending on wagons, bending iron plates, stoking fires, breaking up caliche, wheeling out refuge, putting nitrate into sacks, all beneath the fierce heat of a sun, as painful as looking into a blast furnace. The desert was being torn up and consumed. The vast empty Atacama transformed in a few years into what one visitor called a vast number of anthills. But even the new flood of nitrate money was not enough to save Peru. Its government, lurching from crisis to crisis, finally decided in the mid-1870s that it should take over the nitrate industry, nationalize it, and rake in even bigger profits. The refinery owners, mostly Europeans and Chileans, were dead set against it and considered armed insurrection rather than giving up their business. The large number of Chileans working Peru's mills added another dimension to the issue. In 1874, an attempted revolution was funded and armed in part by Chileans who, it was said, wanted to use the unrest to take over some of Peru's nitrate holdings. It failed. But the nitrate producers began thinking hard about a way out from under the Peruvian government. Increasingly, they looked for help to the south, to Chile. The government of Peru, an observer of the day wrote, is and has been, from the commencement of its republican history, as unstable as water. Chile was a different story. The two nations, close geographically and tied by a common language, differed in almost every other way. Peru, home of almost all the easy wealth, the gold and silver of the Incas, had as a result received most of the attention from Spain. The Spanish conquistadores had turned it into a vassal nation, raped it, and looted its riches. It became, even after independence, a nation of a few very rich families ruling many extremely poor citizens. Chile, by comparison, had many fewer Indians, far less natural wealth, and a heavier influence of settlement by German and British immigrants. The Peruvian tradition was one of aristocratic control, slave labor, and resource exploitation. The Chilean tradition was relatively progressive, nationalistic, enterprising, and aggressive. The Chilean government was stable. Chileans were compared by some historians to the American pioneers. The two nations had been allies briefly during the Guano War with Spain, but traditionally acted more like competing brothers. The competition began to turn into a brawl when they both saw something they wanted, the desert nitrate. As complaints from Chileans working in Peru increased, the two nations began gauging each other's military forces. If Chile buys one warship when an oft-quoted dictum of the era, Peru must buy two. There was a third player in the region, too, Bolivia, which controlled a strip of nitrate desert between Chile and Peru, including a nitrate port. Chile had a long-standing dispute with Bolivia over where exactly one nation ended and the other began. 20 years earlier, the dispute had been about little more than a small point of national pride. Now it was about big money. Peru, alarmed by Chile's growing naval strength, urged Bolivia to reject any Chilean claims. Peru and Bolivia signed a secret mutual defense pact. The nitrate war started in 1879. The Bolivians made good targets. Their uniforms were the color of the mountains and jungles. Bright green and yellow and red, easy to spot against the dull sands of the Atacama. They had marched down from their homes high in the Andes under the command of the nation's newest dictator, General Don Hilarion Daza, an adventurer of the lowest and worst type, a man whose military abilities were no match for his greed. To stay in power, Daza needed to keep his army happy, so he rifled the Bolivian treasury to pay his officers and men. He needed jobs to keep his people from revolting, so he arranged flexible, often graft-driven deals with foreign firms that would employ Bolivians in the mining of their abundant silver. He needed jobs to keep his people from revolting, so he arranged flexible, often graft-driven deals with foreign firms that would employ Bolivians in the mining of their abundant silver. The Daza regime, installed in fortresses high in the mountains, was renowned less for its good works than it was for its corruption and much whispered about palace orgies. When he heard that money was being made in his nation's distant holdings in the Atacama from the mining of a valuable salt, Daza ordered a small increase in the taxes being paid by the industry. Most of the work in Bolivia, as in Peru, was being done by Chileans. His advisors told him that this was not possible. One of Daza's predecessors had broken a deal with Chile in which a border dispute had been settled in exchange for tax breaks for Chilean settlers, including a promise not to raise taxes on the nitrate works. Daza, however, would not be bound by the negotiations of the past. Daza decided to levy his tax anyway. It was not much, just enough to kill a few thousand soldiers. Enterprising Chileans in the Bolivian Atacama had already turned a fishing village into a major nitrate shipping port. In the late 1870s, the population of this fast-growing Bolivian city, called Antofagasta, was 90% Chilean. When Daza levied his tax, the manager of the region's biggest nitrate company, run by Chilean and English businessmen, refused to pay. Daza responded to this affront by taking over the company in Bolivia's name. Chileans in the area called for help from the government of Chile. On February 14, 1879, without warning, 200 Chilean troops arrived by ship in Antofagasta harbor and marched up the dock through lines of cheering residents. The Chileans did not want bloodshed. They quickly took control of the town and gave the town's Bolivian prefect and all other Bolivians free passage back to their homes in the mountains. When news of this insult reached Daza, he declared war on Chile. He was quickly joined by his secret ally, Peru. Daza personally led his Bolivian soldiers. It was a mistake from the start. Daza was as poor a general as he was a politician. His troops were soundly beaten by the Chileans whenever they met. Within weeks, Daza fled back to the Andes with what troops he had left, leaving a relatively small Chilean military force in control of almost all of what had been the Bolivian Atacama. It was a humiliating defeat. Bolivia lost its nitrate holdings and its arm to the sea. It remains to this day a landlocked nation, and Daza was ousted. He fled with a chunk of the national treasury, first to Europe, then to Peru. When he tried to return to Bolivia a few years later, he was shot to death at the border. He had, however, succeeded in one thing. He had started what was called the War of the Pacific, or the Nitrate War. At stake was the entire Atacama, including the Tarapacá's rich nitrate fields and all the fortunes being made there. a natural resource important enough to change the fate of nations. It was a prize worth winning. This war for the desert was fought largely on the sea. In a land as dry and endless as the Atacama, only the sea offered a way to move troops and arms quickly and safely. Control of the sea meant control of the war. On paper, Chile looked to have the advantage. Its ships were newer and faster. But Peru had two superior weapons. One was an aging, slow, but almost impregnable ironclad, a floating fort sheathed in 4 inches of iron plating called the Huascar. The other was that ship's captain, Miguel Maria Guau Seminario, the former director of the Peruvian Naval Academy. Guau was a talented naval strategist. He knew that the Huascar was not the fastest or most up-to-date ironclad afloat, but he also knew that it was a heavyweight in any fight with armor thick enough to repel enemy cannonballs. 2 huge cannons housed in a squat revolving tower and an iron beak, a ram that could slice a hole in the enemy and sink them at close quarters. One-on-one, Guau felt he could sink or capture any ship in the Chilean Navy. Both sides focused on the port of Iquique. Darwin's gloomy fishing village now sported new docks and an imposing stone Peruvian blockhouse on the waterfront. As soon as the war started, the Chileans blockaded Iquique, denying Peru money from nitrate shipments and waiting for a chance to take the town. Guau, the Peruvian naval commander, determined to break the blockade. A cat-and-mouse game ensued. The Chileans were rightly nervous about the Huascar and its captain, so they sent some of their blockade ships north from Iquique toward Lima to find and sink Guau. But he was already steaming to Iquique in the Huascar, accompanied by Peru's only other ironclad in good shape to send to sea, the Independencia. Somehow he got to Iquique without being seen. There were only 2 Chilean ships maintaining the blockade. What the Chileans lacked in power, they made up for in courage. One of the Chilean ships, the Corvette Esmeralda, was commanded by a handsome 31-year-old officer named Arturo Prat. When the Huascar was sighted at dawn, Prat, according to local lore, went below, put on his parade uniform, and roused his men with an impassioned speech. "Lads," he said, "the battle will be unfair, but cheer and courage. Our flag has never been hauled down before the enemy, and I hope this will not be the occasion to do it. For my part, I assure you that as long as I live, this flag will blow in its place, and if I die, my officers will know how to fulfill their duties." Guau went after Pratt's ship. The other Chilean tried to escape, with the Peruvian Independencia giving chase. The Huascar trapped Prat against the coastline and started hammering the Esmeralda with its big guns. By now, crowds of cheering Peruvians from Iquique were lining the waterfront, welcoming Guau, bringing out what cannon they had, and taking pot shots at Prat's ship. Running out of the room, Prat repositioned the Esmeralda so that the Huascar would have to fire at an odd angle to avoid hitting fellow Peruvians on shore. For the next hour and a half, the 2 ships traded blows. The Chilean fire was more accurate, but their cannonballs bounced harmlessly off the Huascar's iron plating. A cannonball from the Huascar killed the Chilean surgeon and beheaded his assistant. Then the Peruvians on shore began to hit the Esmeralda with cannon fire. Prat tried to reposition, but his engine started failing. Then a boiler burst, and the Esmeralda was dead in the water. For the next hour and more, the Huascar continued smashing the crippled Chilean ship, disabling its cannons and softening it up for a final approach with the ram. Perhaps Prat should have surrendered, but he had promised his men that he would never lower the Chilean flag. Guau ordered the Huascar to back up a bit, then steam forward and smash into the Esmeralda. The Huascar's ram tore open the Chilean ship below the waterline. As his ship shuddered from the blow, the 2 ships, deck to deck, Prat raised his sword and ordered his men to board the Huascar and take it hand to hand. Perhaps his crew did not hear through the noise. Perhaps the sight of the Huascar's Gatling gun sweeping the deck dissuaded them. Whatever the reason, only Pratt, still brandishing his sword, and a single sergeant armed with a pistol and a boarding hatchet made it onto the Huascar's deck. Within seconds, the sergeant fell mortally wounded. Pratt ran across the deck alone toward the bridge of the Garou's ship. The Peruvian officers were for a moment too stunned to speak. Then Garou issued an order to take the enemy captain alive. But it was too late. There was a shot, and Pratt fell to one knee. There were more shots, and he died on the Huascar's deck. Garou ordered his men to carry Pratt's body below. Then he ordered the Huascar back and rammed the Esmeralda again. This time, Pratt's second-in-command tried to board the Peruvian ironclad, and Chinchillians made it onto the Huascar before the Gatling gun cut them down. The Esmeralda was sinking, its deck almost awash, when the ironclad rammed a third time. It finally sank, still flying the Chilean flag. 148 of the Esmeralda's 198 crew members were dead. The Huascar lost one sailor. An admiring American historian later called Pratt's final minutes the greatest act of bravado in a naval battle since the days of John Paul Jones. Garou was deeply impressed as well and sent Pratt's young widow all of his personal belongings, including his sword, with a note. Dear Madam, I have a sacred duty that authorizes me to write you, despite knowing that this letter will deepen your profound pain by reminding you of recent battles. During the naval combat that took place in the waters of Iquique between the Chilean and Peruvian ships on the 21st day of the last month, your worthy and valiant husband, Captain Mr. Arturo Pratt, commander of the Esmeralda, was, as you cannot ignore any longer, victim of his reckless valor in defense and glory of his country's flag. While sincerely deploring this unfortunate event and sharing your sorrow, I comply with the sad duty of sending you some of his belongings, invaluable for you, which I list at the end of this letter. Undoubtedly they will serve of small consolation in the middle of your misfortune, and I have hurried in remitting them to you. Reiterating my feelings of condolence, I take the opportunity of offering you my services, considerations, and respects, and I render myself at your disposal. Both sides claim victory at Iquique. The Peruvians sank the Esmeralda. The Chileans gained a national hero in Arturo Pratt. The town square and leading hotel in Iquique are now named after him. Chile also benefited from a lucky accident. While chasing the second blockade ship, Peru's Independencia, that nation's only other seagoing ironclad, ran into a reef and sank. For several months after the Battle of Iquique, Garou and his impregnable Huascar ruled the seas off Chile and Peru, the ironclad destroying or capturing every Chilean ship it could catch, bombarding ports, preventing Chile from moving men by sea, and sinking Chile's hopes of a quick victory. Garou moved slowly but stealthily, struck by surprise, and always seemed one step ahead of the Chileans. He was promoted to Grand Admiral of Peru's Navy. His country people dubbed him El Caballero de los Mares, the Knight of the Seas. By the fall of 1879, Chile realized that its only hope of victory had to start with the sinking or capture of Huascar. Six of Chile's best warships were devoted to the task. They finally met Garou on October 8. What shaped up to be a major sea battle ended quickly when a lucky Chilean shot hit the Huascar's bridge, killing Garou and several of his officers. 2 hours later, the Huascar was captured. As the news spread, Chilean crowds danced in the streets, chanting insults, called the Peruvians cowards and guinea pigs. In Peru, guinea pigs are roasted and eaten, and shouted, "On to Lima!" The loss of one ship changed the entire nature of the war. With the Huascar captured and Garou dead, the Chilean Navy controlled the Pacific from one end of South America to the other. They quickly captured Iquique, started shipping soldiers north, and prepared to take the war to Peru's heartland. 15 months after losing Huascar, the Peruvians had been beaten on every front. Now they were trying desperately to stop the Chilean forces from capturing their capital city. An American on the scene wrote, I followed the thoroughly disorganized Peruvian army into Lima. Here we found the city in the hands of a mob, which plundered and burned to their heart's content. Bullets flew through the streets as thick as hail. The yells of wounded men, the shrieks of the frightened women, the glare of 100 fires all went to form about as perfect a picture of hell as one could well imagine. In the end, he wrote, it came as something of a relief when the Chileans marched in and restored order.